On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman goes for the big view and the catching phrase with his global reporting and bracing books, From Beirut to Jerusalem, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, and The World is Flat. He has won 3 Pulitzer Prizes and a raft of devoted readers. Then came Iraq. Friedman supported going in and transforming the region. Now he calls George Bush's war contemptible, and the arresting phrase-maker sounds nearly desperate to disengage from Mideast oil, to build a wall of energy independence, to save the climate and American competitiveness in a world where China is coming on strong. Up next on Point, world-watching columnist Tom Friedman on his too warm winter of discontent. Tom Friedman, welcome. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. Good to be here, Tom.
Pretty tough this week. You're saying to the president, the way you have fought this war with our pinky is contemptible. What do you mean? What do you suggest?
Well, one has to really go back to the beginning, Tom, and back to even to the pre-war. My view from the very beginning was that there was something very important at stake here. And it really, as I say, goes back for me to 9/11. I think that we treated the Arab world for 50 years, Democrats and Republican administrations, as a collection of big, dumb gas stations, basically. That's how we treated the Arab world, both parties, both presidents from both parties. And we had this view that I would describe as follows. We had the view, we kind of told the leaders of those countries, guys, and it was only guys, just keep your pumps open, your price low, and be nice to the Jews, be nice to the Israelis, and you can do whatever you want out back. You can treat your women however you like. You can educate your kids however poorly you like. You can preach whatever intolerance from your mosques or places of worship as you like. And you can deprive your people of whatever civil rights you like. Just keep the pump open, the price low, and be nice to the Jews. And you can do whatever you want out back. Well, it's my view, Tom, it was my view back then and is my view today, that on 9/11, we got hit with the distilled essence of everything going on out back. That's really what bin Laden and bin Ladenism represent. It was the crystallization of all those pathologies. So as I approached the Iraq War question from the very beginning, I was never part of the neocon, drumbeat for Iraq War. My view was these guys are going to do it, and if they're going to do it, let's do it for the right reasons and the right way. And for me, the right reasons were to see if we could collaborate with people in the heart of the Arab Muslim world to put that part of the world on a different track. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, if we could deal with that context of what was going on out back. I believe that was a really important project. I still believe it. And so, I also believed that it was a really hard project. And what I emphasize before, during, after, and since is that this project is really important and really hard. My criticism of the Bush administration before the war, during, and since was they thought it was really important and really easy, that it could be done with a minimal number of troops, quick and easy, in and out. And I believe history will damn them for that view that something this important could be that easy.
Important to do it. We'll look at the details of how you say it ought to have been done or should be done now. But let me ask you this simple question to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, Tom Friedman. When it comes to the Iraq War and the Middle East, are we better off now than we were 4 years ago?
No, we're obviously not better off now. I also, of the many things I'm responsible for coining, one of them was my Pottery Barn rule, you break it, you own it, and which Colin Powell adopted in his own conversation with the president. We broke it, and we really never took ownership of it, Tom. And as a result, as we stand here today, there is no way any rational, sane person could argue that as we stand here today, that we are now better off.
Tom Friedman, you and I talked about the warts maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago now, and we went.
Did we talk before? I'm trying to remember whether we talked. I know we've had several conversations, yeah. or at least two, and I just was trying to remember this morning when we talked.
Well, I don't remember the date of the last one, but we went through this. Where, or I really pressed you on a columnist's responsibility.
Right.
If a doctor recommends surgery by a surgeon who can't pull it off, what's the doctor's responsibility? In that case, Dr. Tom Friedman.
Right.
We don't have to retread that exactly. We went through that, but here you are absolutely clamoring now. And
right.
you're saying, yes, I would surge, but the surge you're talking about has quite different dimensions than what President Bush is talking about. And you seem just about out of your skull in determination to get the message out there. What is it?
Well, basically, Tom, you know, again, if you were to go back to what I wrote before the war. Actually, you know, the first column I wrote after the first month, it was one of the first columns I wrote after 9/11, called for a patriot tax, a gasoline tax. It called for summoning the country because people really did want to be summoned to do what they could do to contribute to the a war on radical, you know, violent Islamism that we faced after 9/11. So it's not like I've suddenly come to this new, you know, in the last few weeks or months. This has been a consistent theme of mine, you know, since the days after 9/11. What is it? What am I really talking about? And how come I've come to this position now? And I've come to reinforcing this position now, I should say. You know, basically, Tom, my view is that this project, this necessity of trying to tilt the Arab Muslim world onto a different track is a really important one for that part of the world and for the world my girls are going to grow up in, for global stability, okay? Mm-hmm. We've tried to do it purely with a military operation. That has failed. I believed all along we needed an energy policy, a different energy policy. Now, given the fact that the military operation has failed, I think it's the only thing we have left. So what am I talking about, basically? It's my view that my favorite country in the world, Tom, is Taiwan. Taiwan. Why Taiwan? Mm. Taiwan is a barren rock in a typhoon-laden sea, and it has the fourth largest financial reserves in the world. And you know why it has the fourth largest financial reserves in the world? One reason, I think a big reason, is because its people have learned to drill their people, unlock their energy and entrepreneurship rather than drilling an oil well or a diamond mine. In other words, you know, when you have the kind of exogenous natural resources that the Arab Muslim world has, you can indulge in the most irresponsible leadership and radical behavior because somebody else will always pay for it.
The resource curse that everybody talks about.
Exactly.
You're saying,
let me give you an example,
dry it up,
Tom,
by helping drive down or at least cap energy prices by capping America's appetite for that oil.
Exactly. So let me give you a couple of examples. I wrote a piece last year in Foreign Policy Magazine I called The First Law of Petropolitics. And to me, the first law of petropolitics is really at the center of my thinking here. It can explain a lot of where I've come out here on the surge. And why I call for a surge, you know, in lowering energy prices. I believe that the price of oil and the pace of freedom operate in an inverse correlation, okay? Mm-hmm. And I can actually prove this. That is, if you draw oil prices, a graph of oil prices from 1980 till the year 2006, what you'll see, basically, if you overlay on that the Freedom House Freedom Index for different countries like Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Iran, what you'll see as the price of oil went down from the 1980s to the mid-1990s, the pace of freedom went up in all these countries. And as the price of oil went up, the pace of freedom goes down. So when oil was $20 to $30 a barrel, Iran was calling for a dialogue of civilization, elected a whole series of moderates for its parliament, and Khatami is president. When oil prices were $70 a barrel, Iran's calling for the destruction of Israel, wipes out all the moderates and their newspapers, and says the Holocaust is a myth. Well, I'll tell you something, in my view, Tom, at $20 a barrel, I promise you, the Holocaust is not a myth anymore. You know, Iran backed Hezbollah's war with Israel last summer and basically wrote Hezbollah a blank check. Do you think Hezbollah would have been able to conduct that war and then go back to its people after and say, we'll build all your houses now, if Iran weren't reaping the tremendous oil profits it's reaping today?
Do you think American politicians can put the price of oil at $20 a barrel?
No, there is no single politician, and there's no single policy that we in the United States alone can do that tomorrow is going to bring the price to $20 a barrel. But if we fundamentally restructured our energy policy around what I call a Green New Deal, okay, I believe we could put our country on a leadership track that would not only bring the price of oil down in the United States but globally, but at the same time would set an example for the whole world and trigger a spate of innovation that ultimately, I think, would have a huge impact on oil prices. Why is this important? I want to point to the first Arab Gulf country to discover oil was, Tom? The first Arab Gulf country to discover oil is a place called Bahrain, a tiny island state off the east coast of Saudi Arabia. It happens that the first Arab Gulf country to run out of oil is also Bahrain. The first Arab Gulf country to hold a free and fair election where women could run and vote was Bahrain. The first Arab Gulf country to sign a free trade agreement with the United States was Bahrain. The first Arab Gulf country to hire McKinsey to reform its labor laws so all its people could be mobilized for the workforce was, say it with me now, Bahrain.
Saudi Arabia is not running out of oil anytime soon, neither is
right.
Iran.
And that's not an accident, Tom. So that's really at the root of my thinking, that obviously, the war option has not worked. The war option alone was never going to work. And part of my whole agenda from the very beginning was obviously an Arab-Israeli peace strategy, the military strategy, and the oil strategy. And right now, with the military strategy having failed, I think if you still care, as I do, about promoting reform in that part of the world, which I think is enormously important, then we're left right now with one tool that's still in our hands, and that is bring down the price of oil. You know, the motto of our revolution, Tom, as you know from Boston, was, because of a little tea party there, no taxation without representation. You know what the model of the Arab autocrats is? No representation without taxation. Hey, pal, if I don't have to tax you, I don't have to represent you.
Tom, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join you, and I want to begin to bring them in right here. Ishwa is calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Ishwa, you're on the air with Tom Friedman.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, what's on your mind, Ishwa?
This is Tom Friedman. I used to read your articles in New York Times even long before the Iraq War started, and I used to consider you as an intellectual person who has wide enough experience and spent a lot of time in the Middle East. But, you know, to look into when you supported the war, in spite of all your intellect and experience that you have spent and used and preached as in your articles about Middle East, your know is actually worse than most of the neocons, whether it is Bush and his cohorts, who have never, most of them have never put, you know.
What do you mean worse than that, Ishwa? What do you mean?
Like, they had an excuse of ignorance. They never set foot in Middle East. They don't understand, they haven't read books. They never understand history. Here is a guy, Tom Friedman, who has done all that, still went along to ride on a what he called winning horse, and when the war is not going well, he deserts them. He's a classic example of intellectual deception.
Tom?
He's a classic example of rats running out of a sinking ship.
Tom Friedman, Ishwa's going to be tough on you here.
Sure. It's a perfectly legitimate question, Ishwa. Well, you know, if before the war you said you thought it was important, you thought it was important for these reasons and had to be conducted in this way, and the war was not conducted that way, and from the day one of the war you said it's not being conducted the right way, and then it's not going well, and you continue to say it needs to be conducted differently, I'm not quite sure what else one is supposed to do. Should I stay on the sinking ship and continue to applaud? Would that be the right position to do? Look, I understand people who oppose the war, and some opposed it for military reasons because they're against war. Some opposed it because they hate George Bush. Some opposed it because, you know, they didn't believe Arabs are capable of democracy. I wasn't in that group. I really believe that finding a different kind of politics in collaboration with people in that region was a really important project.
And do you
really
believe...
Next time, Ishwa, I really promise I will be a better liberal. I will not in any way support any effort to bring democracy to a country ruled by an oil-backed tyranny. I promise I will never do that again. I promise I will be a better liberal. I will view the prospect of Arabs forging a democracy as utterly impossible. They're incapable of democracy. I agree with you on that. Now.
You're going to sarcasm. We can feel you've taken your licks on this. But let me ask you, Tom, do you really believe that...
Let me just finish this point, which is to say, I think Ishwa's point, it's a legitimate point. People are against the war. You're against it. And now I think that people have to think through, what were the arguments that people were making before the war? Why did they think it was important? Why did they think it could go wrong? But some people think it was failed, doomed from the beginning.
Here's the fundamental, just honest question. Do you really think it could have worked? If it would have been done with the perfect Tom Friedman formula, but war was still at the center of it. Now, I mean, Americans look now at Iraq and it looks like, oh my gosh, how is this thing ever going to hold together? It strains credulity to imagine that it might have. Do you really believe that there was another way to turn the dials that would have led to the success you hoped for?
Yeah. I've actually been to Iraq 5 times since the war. And one of the things that really struck me from the very beginning certainly was that this definitely was possible under a different security structure.
More troops, less chaos, and it would have been a different picture there?
Oh, I definitely think that it is possible that it would have been. And to say, you're asking me, is it impossible that it would have been? Absolutely not. Let's remember, Tom, what the opponents of the new democratically elected government in Iraq had to do. The level of violence they undertook before they finally provoked the Shiites into the response and the civil war that we're in right now. Mm. We had 2 years where Sistani was basically holding back the entire Shiite community from responding to these provocations by the Baathists and insurgents. Let's remember what happened during those first 2 years. So if you're asking me, is it a sure thing? I knew it wasn't a sure thing from the beginning, okay? But if you're asking me, was it impossible? No, I don't believe it was impossible. I think different decisions could have led to different outcomes.
Let's take a call from Toronto, if I may. Robert's calling. Hi, Robert. You're on the air with Thomas Friedman.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Friedman.
Hi.
Hello?
Yes, we
Hi,
hear
Robert.
You loud and clear.
Okay. Mr. Friedman, first of all, your columns are basically, most of the time, directly or indirectly, protecting the interests of Israel, okay? And you just said that Arabs are not capable of democracy.
I didn't say that. What I was saying was that's the view of people who oppose the war, some people.
Okay.
It's not my view. It's precisely 100% not my view, which is why I hope that this could work.
Okay. Now, sir, we are standing at a very critical juncture of the history. Okay, first of all, wars are wrong. They were wrong all the time. Whether it's right or wrong, wrong today, wrong will be in the future. But unless we resolve the issue of the Palestinian issue, this is the issue that is haunting the whole world. It's just not the Arabs, and it won't go away as long as we hide. We try to play around through our columns and all those things is not going to work, sir.
Robert, let us pick it up. Tom Friedman, you talk a lot lately at a very high volume about energy. You've written a lot about Israel and the Palestinians as well. To trace the roots of the crisis here, how much goes to energy? How much goes to Israel?
Anyone who's been reading me for 10 years, I'm the guy who, came up with the Abdullah Peace Plan, an interview with the King of Saudi Arabia, to suggest that all I do is protect Israel's interests in my column is such fatuous, dishonest nonsense. I just don't know where to get into it. It's so stupid, Tom, it's so contrary to what I've written. I'm a big believer in the peace process, always have been. I believe in a two-state solution. I believe Israelis will never be home unless Palestinians are, and Palestinians will never be home unless Israelis are. If you're a friend of that solution, I'm your friend. If you're not a friend of that solution, I'm your enemy. Now, do I think that finding a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict is important? Well, of course I do. I've devoted, so much of my journalism to promoting just that. But will it solve the problem between Sunnis and Shiites? Will that stop a Sunni jihadi suicide bomber from going into a mosque in Bakuba and blowing it up on the first day of Ramadan? No, I'm sorry. That's a huge cop-out.
There you go. Robert in Toronto. Tom, here we are right now. The president wants 20,000 more troops, a little more. You're saying that's not enough. You want a lot here. You want a cap on the price of oil. The federal government to say, we won't let it effectively go below $40 a barrel so that Wall Street can step up and invest in alternative energy. That takes a while. In the interim, what do you suggest on Iraq right now in the next 6 months?
Well, I said two things in that column, mm-hmm. Tom. Set a deadline and set a floor price.
Mm-hmm. A deadline for what exactly in Iraq?
A deadline to withdraw from Iraq. Mm-hmm. I've said this now basically since the summer when it became obvious to me that this was not working. I did the rational and responsible thing as a columnist. I said what I hoped for is not working, and we need a plan B, as the column was called, Time for Plan B. Mm. And basically, in various columns since then, I've been arguing for two things. One is a deadline for withdrawing from Iraq, which I believe is necessary if we have any hope of salvaging a political solution now. It will only be if all the parties are faced with the hard reality that if they do not make the compromises to live together, we are going to leave by a fixed date. So if they want to continue to behave in the way some of them at the extreme have been behaving, they will have to pay retail for their violence, not wholesale, because America will not provide a floor for one side or the other to engage in that kind of behavior.
That means you believe there's still enough willingness, readiness, inclination in Iraq to go for a kind of negotiated solution between all the sects to achieve
it.
It
means, Tom, if there is that willingness, we're only going to bring it out if people have to face the full and ugly prospect that it'll be a war of all against all if we leave. That's what it is.
Does it make a difference that the Democrats took Congress in November? You describing President Bush's pursuit of the war as contemptible. Democrats have just been there a couple of weeks now. In your calculation, does that change the future outlook?
And by the way, I've been calling the way Bush has been pursuing the war contemptible for years, okay, and various other adjectives. Does the Democrats being there change it? I don't know. It depends what the Democrats do. What's the Democrats' energy policy, Tom? I've kind of missed that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a Democrat calling for a carbon tax? Is there a Democrat calling for a BTU tax? Is there a Democrat calling for a gasoline tax? What's their problem? I don't see a lot of profiles in courage on the Republican side of the aisle or on the Democratic side of the aisle. And I think both parties are completely missing the fact that the public and the business community is so many miles ahead of them on this green issue. It is, to me, just like women's suffrage. Mm. The public is so much prepared, is so ready to be led on this issue. And no one so far in either party that I see is stepping up to it in a serious way.
So turn your analytical eye home. Turn your eye home then, Tom. Why? I mean, you analyze politics abroad all the time. If the public's ready, if the geopolitics, geostrategy are crying out for it, as you write, why doesn't it happen?
I think both parties are afraid that somehow they're going to be attacked by the other party if they call for a tax. Now, I'll tell you, Tom, I'm just a lonely columnist at the New York Times. But if I were a politician, if I were in a presidential debate and I had called for a gasoline tax and my opponent said, My opponent here is for a gasoline tax, ladies and gentlemen. Mm. You're going to pay more money at the pump if you elect Friedman. I would love to be in that debate, Tom. I would love to be able to say, you're right. My opponent is right. I am for a tax. Now, he's for a tax, too. He just wants his tax to go to the Saudi treasury and the Iranian treasury to support madrasas and terrorist groups. I'm just kind of a simple American. I prefer my tax to go to the American treasury. But let's cut the crap here. We're both for a tax. I just prefer my tax go to the American Treasury.
Let's take a call from Amy in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Amy. You're on the air with Tom Friedman.
Hi, Tom. I'm trying to put your commentary on the war in Iraq into a greater perspective, thinking about your book, The World is Flat. And in that book, you cite these 10 flatteners, two of which off the top of my head being outsourcing and offshoring that really drove global capitalism, helped the U.S. get things done very efficiently, very cheaply. But I'm wondering if that same ethic is what is also undermining the interests of the United States right now with respect to the war, with respect to the economy, with respect to the environment. Is it possible for us to, use those flatteners, that ethic, adhere to that, do things like, do business with China, where we know that they're undermining environmental standards, labor standards, a living wage, just to get low-cost goods? I mean, that's also why we are in the war in Iraq, because we're trying to get cheap resources, cheap oil.
So can we have it both ways? Tom, what do you say?
It's a good question, Amy. It takes a little longer answer than that. Remember, cheap goods, from China also translate into accessible goods for millions of Americans who can only afford to shop at Walmart. So let's remember that side of it. But I think that the broader point you're making, Amy, if I understand it, is one I agree with. And again, why go back to an energy policy? If we're going to call on the rest of the world to join us in a war on terrorism, you're either with us or against us. And then we say to the rest of the world, oh, but on that Kyoto energy thing, sorry, can't be with you, going to drive my SUV or my Hummer. That's just not on. If we are going to call on the rest of the world to be with us, we have to be the best global citizen we can be. And I don't think we've been that. And I think that's one of the reasons we are so dancing alone in the Middle East. Bush has enormous moral clarity and no moral authority.
We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman about America's new rough path in the world and what to do about it. His latest book is The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Let's go to Tampa, Florida, and Anthony. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air with Tom Friedman.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. What do you see?
I guess what I didn't expect, and what's been interesting about this conversation to me, is that with other callers calling up and wanting to take Mr. Friedman on in various ways about what he's said and what he's written, and the conversation has become about what he believes, what he thinks, which, as a columnist for New York Times is certainly valid. But at the same time, I think it's clear that the people who make policy and have the power to enact policy are not listening to Mr. Friedman. So I wonder, from his perspective, who he thinks his audience is. Who is he trying to talk to?
Tom?
Wow, that's a really good... It was Anthony?
Yes.
That's a really good question. First of all, I really welcome being on the show and taking everybody's questions, Anthony, because you're out there with your opinion, and you should have to answer for them. So that's why I'm here, and that's why I do other things like this. But I would say something that I'm guilty of is, in some ways, I was fighting my own war,
What do you mean?
But in fighting my own war, what I mean by sort of laying out my own arguments in the column, obviously I was hoping to use my little white space, without exaggerating it, to tilt the discussion to a different track. That is to say, I never believed in the WMD argument, and wrote that before the war. I said, if you're going to war over WMD, it's the wrong war. Iraq has nothing that's going to threaten us. For me, it was always about PMD, people of mass destruction, and the politics that produces those pathologies. Now, what I would say, Anthony, is that Bush and Cheney really rode that WMD argument into the war. That's how they got the country into it. That's how they really convinced, you know, I would say the great middle in America to go for it. When the WMD didn't show up, they were kind of left with my argument, the argument for democracy. That's when the debate shifted. And my problem, though, was by the time they got around to kind of my argument, making that the centerpiece of what they were doing, they had so, you know, bollocksed simply the security environment in Iraq, going back to the looting, that it was very hard to ever recover. You know, one of the things I learned covering the Lebanese Civil War is that once you let a militia culture get embedded, because people feel insecure, so they fall back on tribe, neighborhood, you know, ethnic group, mosque, or gang, it's very hard to disembed it. So anyone, you know, I wrote before the war that I leaned for the war. My wife leaned against it. Mm-hmm. The argument between me and my wife, though, was not – she always understood my argument about the need to change the context in the heart of that world in collaboration with people there. She always believed that the Bush administration would never do it right. My view was they've already started. They have to do it right. I was wrong about that.
But Tom, and, to Anthony's specific question, he says, given that – that you didn't have their ear, it would seem, or not persuasively at that point exactly. You don't see them following your policy now. You call the latest thing contemptible, and it's not the first time. Anthony's asking, as you sit down at your keyboard, Tom Friedman, who are you writing to and for? Who are your exhortations for?
Right. Well, ultimately, you know, it's for the public at large. I'm not sitting down saying, you know, I have no idea whether the president reads my column or not. You know, you hope so.
You
know,
address him directly, Mr. President. You want to
right, search. But you have no idea whether they do. So you do your best to, I think, shape the wider debate in the hopes that, you know, whether Cheney or Bush or Secretary Rice is reading it this morning, if you can affect the wider debate one way or another, that will ultimately affect the policy. I guess that's the only answer I can give. I don't sit down, you know, every morning and say, I'm writing to the president today. I really consider myself writing to my audience of readers, which I hope will be big and expanding and not small and shrinking.
Do they ever talk to you? Does Condoleezza Rice call and say, Tom, let's have a cup of coffee?
I go in to see the Secretary of State at her initiative, usually once every 3 or 4 months, just to find out what's going on.
What do you think of Condoleezza Rice and the job she's done?
I don't think she deserves high marks. She was central to the pre-war absence of planning. She was central as National Security Advisor to the terrible implementation. And I've been a huge critic of the absence of, going back to an earlier question, an Arab-Israeli diplomatic track. I believed we should have been talking to the Syrians this summer. I went to Damascus to make that point. Doing it with eyes wide open, but I still believe engaging them might have been productive. So I don't see – if you were writing her, you know, encyclopedia entry of her Secretary of Stateship up to now, Tom, if it ended today, you know, other than the India nuclear deal, of which I'm kind of have ambivalent about. I was against it in the beginning, but I've come to see some of the merits now. I'm not sure what you would cite as a single achievement.
Let me ask you about the risk of a region-wide Sunni-Shia conflict. Your newspaper, The New York Times, with a news story this week saying that the hanging of Saddam Hussein, the manner of that hanging, and the hanging and effective beheading of Barzan Ibrahim al-Takridi afterward has just driven a wedge in here that looks like it may well be headed for open conflict. Can you see region-wide armed conflict, Sunni-Shia, breaking out? Are we already on that path?
I just don't know, you know, and I don't want to make some wild prediction. One thing I do know is that these states, Arab states, these sort of quasi-military regimes, they know how to protect themselves. I don't see, I guess if you forced me, you know, to say what the prospects of that are, you know, maybe 30%, but not 60%.
But protecting themselves might entail war, or they might come to understand it as entailing war. I mean,
differently, Tom. Mm-hmm. I would see them maybe fueling a war inside Iraq, just as they fueled the Iran-Iraq war, but that is backing different parties there with arms and money,
but containing
engaging themselves.
Christopher's
call. You know, it's interesting, Tom. I had a group of Egyptian college students, a journalism class, come visit me yesterday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And one of the young women asked me, we had that story in the New York Times, and she asked me, what do I think about that story? And I said, ethnic conflict, differences between religious factions, whether Protestants, Catholics, Jews, you know, Hindus, Muslims, that's as old as history, you know, and it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing, you know, an explosion of that now in the Middle East. But I said to her, you know what really surprises me and saddens me and disturbs me is that there's no Martin Luther King in this picture. There's no Gandhi. What doesn't surprise me is that there's tension, violence between Sunnis and Shiites. What surprises me and really distresses me is that there's no million Muslim march under the banner of that we are all the sons and daughters of the Prophet Muhammad. There is nothing. And if you ask me, Tom, you know, why, you know, what was it that really tipped you that this thing in Iraq isn't working, that we got to go to Plan B? I can tell you the day. It was Ramadan of 2005, the first day of Ramadan. Sorry, Ramadan, it would have been 2006, when a Sunni jihadi suicide bomber walked into a mosque in Bakuba and blew it up in the middle of a funeral. And there was not, as far as I could tell, a peep of protest, certainly nothing large scale, in the entire Muslim world. And I just said, wait a minute. Think about the cultural and religious gates that person burst through. A suicide bomber against Islam blows up a mosque against Islam on the first day of Ramadan, in the middle of a funeral, and nobody says anything.
How do you interpret
that? Wait a minute.
That?
Pardon me?
How do you interpret that? That moderate voice of outrage at this has not been raised. Are you seeing that as a flaw in Islamic culture in the Middle East, or are you seeing that as a, I don't know, an artifact of how the imperial era and everything else treated them?
No. Well, I think it's a combination of two things. One is a struggle in Islam today, which unfortunately is being won by anti-modernists more than modernists. And second, the fact that there's no political space, even if Muslims wanted to protest, to have a million Muslim march, in the Muslim world at least, not true in Europe, you couldn't organize it. You know, people asked me, Tom, over the last 4 years, hey, how will you know whether we've succeeded in Iraq? What's your measure? And I always had one simple answer. I think we'll have succeeded in Iraq if Salman Rushdie can give a lecture in Baghdad. Well, what did I mean by that? What I meant was, you know, I going back again to 9/11, that's where I start. Mm. Not because Saddam was part of 9/11. He had nothing to do with it. But the pathologies of the region that produce people like bin Laden, they grow out of the fact that Islam does need a reformation. But to have a reformation, you need a free space. You need a space where people of all different views on Islam, from Salman Rushdie to the most conservative, can actually argue out these ideas. And if there's one problem we have, I call it the wheel of bin Laden. Yes, this is what I hope to break. And I saw the war as possibly being able to do it. But what is that wheel? It starts with authoritarian oil-backed regimes that never have elections, so get their legitimacy by empowering anti-modernist religious educators. The regimes bless them with money and state title, and these anti-modernist religious leaders bless the regimes with legitimacy. These anti-modernists ensure that the education and religious system remains backward. That produces young people by the millions who are unprepared for modernity. That produces humiliation. That is exploited by the anti-modernists. And the wheel of bin Laden goes around and around. Now, you can hate me for the war or you can love me for the war, but that's what I was thinking about. Now, if you don't think that's a danger to our world, our future, their world and their future, I would argue you're really wrong. War, at least the way the Bush administration conducted it, didn't work, okay? I'm now looking for another way, all right, to deal with that problem. But that is at the center of my thinking.
Let's go to the listeners. A lot of them lined up to speak with you. Christopher's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say, you know, I'm a tremendous admirer of Mr. Friedman, and especially his coverage of India and China and globalization generally. But I just want to follow up on the caller from Andover who was asking about the coverage of the war, Mr. Friedman's early coverage of the war. Mm-hmm. And I was actually a little disappointed in Mr. Friedman's answer.
Hmm.
You know,
on what specific issue? Because maybe I can undisappoint you.
Sure. You know, to say, oh, well, what am I supposed to think? You know, that Arab democracy is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
I just found that not a very satisfying answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem is more complicated than that. And
mm-hmm.
if I may make a criticism of your column,
please go. Why? That's what we're here for.
I think you were guilty of a bit of wishful thinking.
Oh, you know, your name is again?
Christopher.
Christopher.
Yes.
A guilty as charged.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm a tremendous admirer of your column.
Guilty as charged.
Okay. So I just wanted to get it out in the open.
Please. It's there's no question that I was guilty of probably, you know, certainly one of my rules of Middle East reporting. I was 100% guilty. I may have wanted it more than they did.
What's the imprint then, Tom Friedman? To Christopher's point, in your thinking since, you know, have you been sobered up in some way? And where
might we be seeing that in your columns? It's a good Christopher's question. It's a legitimate one. And it's a good one you're asking. If somebody were to psychoanalyze these columns, you know, you would probably come away and say this guy's schizophrenic. Because, you know, many even of my worst critics have pointed out, I actually warned before the war about everything that happened. You know, you break it, you own it. I mean, if you go back to my pre-war columns, in fact, my tilting, you know, before the war, and maybe this answers Christopher's question, I gave a lot of speeches before the war, and they were all built on this point. I always say to people, you know, I'm for the war 52-49. Well, they say, what do you mean 52-49? It doesn't add up. I said, I know. There's something irrational, okay, about it. I recognize that. And what is that irrational thing? Here, autobiography is destiny. I am the embodiment of two conflicting forces. A young guy who grew up in Minnesota with a really optimistic outlook, who grew up in a community and a state under Hubert Humphrey and Gene McCarthy and Walter Mondale that worked and really believes in kind of a progressive politics is possible everywhere for everyone. And the same guy who then went to Beirut, covered the Civil War there, saw Hamas, saw Sabra and Shatila, saw the Marine bombing, and saw the difficulty of implanting any kind of progressive politics in that part of the world. And all my columns, then and since, basically have been an internal dialogue in some way between my hope that somehow we could tilt this world in a different direction and my experience there, which told me how difficult and maybe impossible that is. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, you should be aware of, Christopher, is how many young Arabs, you know, my boss, Gail Collins, took her to the Middle East with me once, and she came back and she said, you know, going to the Middle East with Tom Friedman is like going to a mall with Britney Spears, because people come up to me all the time. I'm on Al Jazeera a lot, so people know what I look like.
Mm.
And I got to tell you, you know, before the war and early in the war, there were a lot of young Arabs. Maybe I just happened to meet the six who were, you know, had this view, or maybe they really represented something, who said to me, Mr. Friedman, please keep writing what you're writing. You say what we feel but can't say.
Is the Minnesota optimist still alive in there, Tom Friedman? Is it still alive?
Is the Minnesota optimist there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that will never leave me, Tom. It's part of who I am. But so is the person who covered Hama and invented Hama rules and Sabra and Shatila and the Marine bombing. I still, as much as I say, set a deadline, set a price, this isn't working, I would be lying to you if I said I still don't harbor some hope that we can take a part of the world that has only known top-down monologues from colonial powers, kings, and dictators, and create a horizontal dialogue where the constituent members of an Arab country can produce their own social compact. Because I believe out of that new order will produce young people who can realize their full aspirations, who won't feel humiliated, and who won't want to wrap themselves in dynamite and blow themselves up.
Minnesota boy, still kicking there after a tough patch, and we hear the big call on energy and appreciate it. Tom Friedman, columnist with the New York Times. The latest book is The World is Flat. Tom, thanks as always for being with us.
A pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.